You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another podcast episode of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the network, and today I'm joined by Professor Mark Bender. Mark is professor in Chinese at The Ohio State University, chair of the Department of East Asian Languages and Literatures, and also my former supervisor. Today, we spoke about his new book, The Nuosu Book of Origins, a creation epic from southwest China, translated with Nuosu scholar Aku Wu and religious specialist Jivo Zhouchu, and recently published with the University of Washington Press. The Nuosu are a subgroup of the Yi ethnic group in southwest China, and Mark has been working with scholars and religious specialists from Daliangshan, or the Greater Cool Mountains area of southern Sichuan province, for several decades. The Book of Origins is, in Mark's words, a cosmographic text for how the Nuosu traditionally see themselves and their place in the world. Our conversation spanned both the content of the epic itself and its place in traditional and contemporary Nuosu culture. We also spoke about Mark's interests in epic and the collaborations that are at the heart of his work. It was a fascinating conversation, and that only scratches the surface of this tremendous book, and I hope you'll enjoy. Hello, and welcome to another podcast episode of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Thurston, one of the hosts of the New Books Network, and today I'm joined by Professor Mark Bender. Mark is professor in Chinese at The Ohio State University, chair of the Department of East Asian Languages and Literatures, and my former advisor. Today we're talking about his new book, The Nuosu Book of Origins, a creation epic from southwest China, translated with Nuosu scholar Aku Wu and religious specialist Jivo Zhouchu, and recently published with the University of Washington Press. This book is his 12th, with translations and academic monograph publications spanning almost precisely four decades of engagement with oral traditions and poetry in the People's Republic of China. Professor Bender, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
The pleasure is all ours. So to start off, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about yourself. Folklorists always have the most interesting stories for how they came to the field, and yours, if I remember correctly in my ancient history, is part of what made me want to enter the field. So what's your folklore origin story?
Well, that's a, there's really not much to say, I guess, on that front, but I became interested in Southwest China, probably as a very small kid, our church used to have rummage sales, and there were copies of National Geographic magazine from the 1930s that I got a hold of. And I saw these pictures and photo essays by Joseph Rock and some of the things that he was doing down in Southwest China among the Naxi and some other ethnic groups. And I also was a big fan of dinosaurs, and Roy Chapman Andrews was one of my heroes who did work up in Inner Mongolia. And from a very early age, I sort of had an awareness. And then later on, you know, various things in life sort of led me to an interest in folk culture, oral tradition, and material culture. I spent a number of years in my high school years in parts of Appalachian Ohio, and learned how to do a number of things like blacksmithing and that kind of stuff, which later helped me understand and appreciate a lot of the material culture aspects of some of the epics that I would work on later. And then in college at Ohio State University, I took a course on East Asian art with Susan Huntington, my first semester there, and got into Chinese studies, was really into Ezra Pound's poetry for a while, and got into some of Francis Densmore's translations of Anishinaabe oral literature, and eventually, went on a study abroad trip to Taiwan about 1978 and stayed several months there, stayed over a little bit, and really got into some of the oral and ritual culture there. And then by 1980, I found myself, summer of 1980, about August, I guess it was, found myself on a sort of, I guess, exchange program with Huazhong Gongshui Yuan, Huazhong Technology University. I'm not sure exactly how they translate it now, in Wuhan, and stayed a year there and met people from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, in particular Zha Ru Chang, who helped me publish a book that I translated. It's a very small book, an epic poem from Yi people in Yunnan province. One of my students in my composition class, Miss Wu, was from a Zhuang ethnic group from Guangxi, and she wrote a little paper on some of the antiphonal folk songs of her people. And eventually we went down to the People's Bookstore and then found a small selection of volumes that had been recently republished, things that had been collected in the 1950s, short epics, ballads, and that sort of thing from various ethnic groups in Southwest China. So I grabbed the shortest one and started translating that. My Chinese wasn't so great, and I was having to learn simplified characters at the same time. But Zha Ru Chang of Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, who was there studying English, you know, on a special program, was impressed by my interest in that, and eventually he took me to Beijing, or I rather visited him in Beijing, and we went and had an audience with Zhong Jingwen, who was the great folklorist. And long story short, I wound up in Guangxi the next summer, Guangxi University, and stayed there for about 6 years until 1987, and then came back to Ohio State for graduate school. And during that time in Guangxi, I was able to make several trips to Guizhou and Yunnan province. I was working with Shi Kun, who was one of the language students from Wuhan, but was from Yunnan, and we did some work together, and we made some field trips along with my fiance, Fuwei, to Yunnan province several times, and entered several Yi areas, Chushong Yi area, and Dali and Lijiang, and some of these places right after they had opened up. and I got to see what things were like, you know, there in the mid-80s in that part of the world. And, of course, was working at Guangxi University with Sun Jingyao, the comparative literature scholar, and we edited that journal called Kaori, started that journal called Kaori, Chinese Journal of Comparative Literature, which was really the first new journal of comparative literature that sort of addressed foreign audiences that was created in the 1980s. I think some version of that is still being published in China today. But those were some of my formative years in China. And then, you know, came back and did graduate school, went back in 91 to 92 to Suzhou, did research on Suzhou Pingtan storytelling, and that eventually turned into a book in 2003, Plum and Bamboo. And in the meantime, I got hired on at Ohio State and teaching culture courses and literature courses and, you know, giving courses on oral literature and that sort of thing. And since, I guess, 1999, I'd gone back to China every year for at least a month or two, and eventually got re-involved with things going on in southwest China, because I'd spent a lot of time studying Pingtan in the interim, and got back in, met people like Bamo Chubomo, and then eventually Stephen Harrell, and got back into studying Yi traditions, and through Bamo Chubomo and her sister, Bamo Ayi, I was introduced to Aku Wuwu, or Lo Ching Chun, who's a professor at Southwest Minzu University. And that sort of is the lead in to what, and he's a poet, okay, and I was introduced to him because he was a poet, and Chubomo wanted me to translate his Norsu language poetry into English. So that's sort of the basis for what maybe we'll be talking about later in this interview.
That's great. It's a really fascinating sort of lead up into all of into folklore studies and to all of these things. So I guess maybe one of the questions to start off with is partly, I mean, this is a translation of a literal epic, and it's not the first that you've done. It's actually, by my count, probably the third or the fourth, at least, translation of a literal epic that you've been part of. And so, but epic is not really a popular topic in American folklore studies. What draws you to epic more generally?
There was just something about these particular texts that I started to become familiar with in the early 1980s in China. There had been these teams of folklorists in the 1950s who'd collected epic poetry. Now, China had not been well known for having epic traditions before very, you know, recently. There's even this notion that there were no epic traditions in China. So this is still kind of a new field in Chinese studies, though I would say it certainly dates back to at least the 1950s, especially with this awareness that there are many epic traditions among the ethnic minority groups, you know, King Gasar of the Tibetans and Jangar of the Mongols, and then many of these Southwest epics. And later on, when I, you know, came back to Ohio State, you know, after I sort of had developed sort of these interests, I had coursework with Patrick Mullen, who introduced me to performance folkloristics, and then later got to know John Miles Foley, who further encouraged me on interests in things. And of course, Foley was very, very much into epics. And so it all just sort of came together. I'd had this longstanding relationship with Jin Dan and his family. He was from the Miao or Hmong ethnic group in southeast Guizhou province. And that was one of those places that I visited back in the 1980s and started working with him and his family on translating these epic poems that Jin Dan had been a student of Ma Shui Liang, the famous linguist, and they had come up with a pretty good text that had been edited, you know, to quite a degree, but still I thought it was a pretty good text compared to some of the other things that have just been over-edited from that era. And I was also able to get some examples of the original language and, you know, was given some tips on how to decode certain passages. So I was able to get a sense of, you know, what the original was like, because at that time it was very, very hard to go in and, you know, get oral texts. I did manage some of that, you know, while I was in Guangxi with some of the folk songs and things like that. But, you know, part of the reason was, you know, I was still only had a BA and it was mostly on my own interest, but also these were just sort of new concepts. The performance theory approach hadn't been introduced to China at that time. So, the situation now is a lot different, different expectations on what, you know, would make a good oral text. But anyway, there were a lot of these things being published in the 1980s that had been collected in the 1950s. And this one collection which of epics from the Miao ethnic group that I later called Butterfly Mother, and I translated, rather published a translation of that with Hackett Publishing in 2006. And it was just the sort of worldview that's transmitted in these epics. I mean, you've got these sort of grand scale, you know, lyrical expression of things, but then you also get these very almost fine-grained catalogs of what's there in the environment. Very often, you know, origins of, you know, customs and aspects of material culture and origins of rituals and things like that. And it was, I think, that sort of combination of the detail, cultural detail that's sort of held within these epics that is sort of held in this literary manner where I've been reading this book on the history of the sword in England, in which they talk about the sword, but also the appearance of images of swords and things like Beowulf and so forth. And it was an interesting point put forth in that book that sort of made me think, well, part of my interest in this is because these things in the oral performances, they're being performed by people who, many of whom have probably used these sort of tools, who are familiar with these processes of forging and casting silver ornaments or weaving or what have you. And so the sort of fine detail that's mentioned in these epics, sometimes just a few words, and, you know, Foley's talked about that with his idea of traditional referentiality, where just an image or two can open up all kinds of things. But they especially open up all kinds of things to the audience that is most familiar with those things. And so I always understood, you know, I learned a lot from translating these epics. I found it was absolutely necessary to go down to the rural areas and interact with people. And that's what Jin Dan did. When I went over the first time to Guizhou province with Jin Dan, he took us on an extended several-day visit, and I had, you know, over 100 questions, and we just went through this list, you know, what is this tool, what is this custom, what is this, you know, food, what is this process, what is the singing like, and it was all introduced to me. And so when the Chinese scholars say that these epics are kind of encyclopedias of traditional knowledge, there's a lot to that. And I think that that's sort of where my interest sort of lies, and that there's this kind of mix between this oral living sort of genre in performance, but it also has this reflection of of actually lived life, but also set within these mythical contexts. So you've got these various levels of creativity and experience intertwining together.
It's really fascinating. It makes me think of a translation of a comedy that I was doing recently. There's a proverb in it, and I kept trying to figure out, so what's the big deal about this proverb? And then I was also recently reading a section of the Tibetan Epic of Gesar. There's the proverb right in it. And so, yeah, I mean, how does that, for a culturally appropriate or a culturally competent audience, a reference in a comedy or in a poem or these things can open up this whole world of meaning, linking back to epic and to whole worldviews. I think that's really, yeah, I mean, that's certainly something that I appreciate about it as well. Excellent. So in that, in the previous discussion, you sort of really, you talked a lot about sort of your work with Jindan and the Miao and the Hmong epic that you published as Butterfly Mother in 2006. But now we also have this newer translation of the Norsu Book of Origins. And can you tell us a little bit about how this publication came to be?
Yeah, I'd say one more thing about the Miao epic. We later published another version of that, a trilingual version of that, that was published in China about, I think it was about 2010 or 2011, which is in Miao Romanization from Southeast Guizhou Romanization and Chinese and English. And we worked on that with Jin Dan and his children, Wu Wen, his son, and Wu Yifeng, his daughter. And it's quite interesting that quite a bit of that translation, which was very, very close in many ways to the Butterfly Mother text that I had, but with some changes. But that was, you know, they went around and, you know, got even more portions of the epic and added some of those in there from living singers and things like that. So they created this kind of master text, which I won't get in here today about, you know, the theory behind creating these master texts in China. I've published on that before, but it's an interesting way of looking at things. But I just wanted to mention that that was the result of, you know, about almost, you know, 30 years of interaction with that family. And we have the trilingual volume of that. It's kind of hard to find, but there's copies of it, that are available through library loan in the U.S. Now, in terms of this Norsu Book of Origins, well, this goes back to what I was saying about the poet Aku Wuwu, when Bamo Chubomo and Bamo Ai, who work in, Bamo Chubomo works in the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences and the Ethnic Literature, Institute of Ethnic Literature there in CAS. And she's done, you know, huge amounts of field work among the Norsu people in Southwest China, particularly in Southern Sichuan. And the Norsu are one of the, or is the largest subgroup of the E ethnic group. And the E ethnic group, they're Tibeto-Burman speakers who, you know, lived in the uplands of Southwest China. There's probably about 80 or so different subgroups, mostly in Yunnan, Sichuan, Guizhou, and a few in Guangxi, and actually a few related groups of these Tibeto-Burman speakers of Vietnam also. And the Norsu, they have various divisions of the Norsu as well, mostly in southern Sichuan or on the border of Sichuan in Yunnan province. And Aku Wuwu came out of this milieu in Liangshan Mountains. As a child, he spoke only Norsu language till he was about 7 years old and, went to grade school during the Cultural Revolution, and there were teachers from urban areas in Chengdu or whatever who were, teaching, sent down to the countryside and were teaching these kids. And so this was a chance for Aku open up a whole different world to him. And he eventually went to Southwest University for Nationalities and is now a professor there and a well-known poet, writes in Norsu language and Chinese. And so I was tasked with translating his material into English. And so I, you know, started working with Aku in the early 2000s and managed to publish a few of his Norsu language poems in places like Basalt. I think that was the first one. And then Frank Stewart at Manoa helped us published a number of them. And then quite a few others have appeared in things like Cha, Rattle, Palax, and so forth. And we're still working on those poems today. But it came to a point where one of the things about Aku's work is that he's been influenced, you know, by a whole range of things, you know, French symbolists and all sorts of things. You know, this, of course, there's this huge growth of poetry among e-poets, especially Norsu poets, in the 1980s, starting with Jidi Maja, who's an extremely well-known poet in China today. And he's also of Norsu background. But Aku writes, you know, was really the only one who started writing in Norsu language. Everybody else is writing in Chinese because, you know, it's just easier to get an audience that way. So Aku writes in both. But the content of his poetry relied so much and indexed so much on traditional mythology, traditional forms of expression, such as a ritual chants to call back wandering souls of children and that sort of thing. And this is a difficulty with a lot of the poetry by many ethnic minority poets in China, especially of that era, the 1980s and 90s, early 2000s, that there are all these references to traditional lore. But in Aku's case, it was especially interesting because he was writing in Norsu language. And so he was, you know, it's the direct Norsu words for things rather than, you know, dealing with Chinese equivalents of things. And so it became apparent to me that if you really wanted to understand Aku Wuwu stuff, you have to understand, you know, Norsu traditional lore. And in order to do this, I pretty much determined that, you know, a key text in understanding this lore of the Bimo priests, as they're called, you know, these ritual specialists of this Bimo culture, which I'm still not terribly familiar with, but I've learned, you know, a fair amount about it. But the Norsu Book of Origins is what we're calling it, or the Nuo Tei in E, it's a key text. And if we translated this, we would be, you know, probably, you know, opening up a lot of doors to understanding many more things about traditional culture of the Norsu, but also shedding light and allowing us to understand what the contemporary poets and artists and so forth were doing, because there's a lot of this content of this Book of Origins, you know, touches on so many aspects of traditional life. There's so many templates for traditional behavior. There's certain portions of it which are performed at weddings, certain portions performed at funerals, and then there's examples of various sorts of customs and, of course, accounts of origins of all sorts of things, including the natural world. And this again, is another thing that's drawn me toward these epics, is the way the natural world is portrayed. I've used this word cosmographic before, which sort of draws on Ben Humboldt's ideas of cosmography from the 19th century, and Joni Adamson has written on this and her works on eco-literature. And I sort of picked up that term from her, but it's a very apt term, this cosmographic. It's this sort of view of things where it's not necessarily a human-centric world, but it's this whole vast cosmos there. And when we encounter this in the epic, in these epics, it's often with a kind of intimacy that really speaks to how these groups interact, you know, with their local environments, which in some ways we could take as being sort of positive models for interaction. In other ways, it's also exploitative. You know, a lot of stuff about farming and opening up forests and that sort of thing. So it's that, human activities are also reflected there.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Oh, that's really cool. And I mean, it's clear that it's so important as a text for understanding sort of Nosu history, but also Nosu expression in the current moment. So normally I would work with guests to tell us about their books chapter by chapter, but this book is a little different. The introduction is nearly 100 pages long, and it's full of all this vital contextualizing information. And we hardly have time to go chapter by chapter through the 29 meticulously translated sections of the epic included here. So I'm wondering if maybe we can sort of focus on the introduction, especially because probably many listeners may not be so familiar with the Nosu or with the Book of Origins more generally. So, and then maybe we can sort of move into a broader conversation of the epic. To start off with, who are the Nosu? So, I mean, we've used this word several times in our conversation so far, but who are they and where in the broader area designated as Southwest China do they live?
Yeah, as I mentioned, most of the Nosu, who number over 2 million, live in what is called the Cool Mountain area of southern Sichuan province, taking up several present-day provinces. Up until the 1950s, they'd been managed to sort of isolate themselves up in the mountains. The history is quite unclear about, their origins, where they come from. There's all sorts of tantalizing sort of clues that they may have had some sort of relationship with maybe more northern peoples at one time, ancient Chang people from up in areas that would be maybe Qinghai province today. But, later on, came farther south. There may have been some sort of connection with subgroups of Mongols, possibly ancient connections to India. It's very, very unclear about where they came from, but they were a caste society until the 1950s. There was this upper class, what has often been called the Black Nosu or the Black E, sort of at the top of things, and then several subcastes of White E or White Norsu, or actually White E, actually, below them with various names in E language. And the lowest caste would have been captured people, captured and enslaved people, you know, from surrounding areas where the, you know, according to the stories, the Norsu warriors would descend upon, you know, various villages and carry off, you know, mostly Han, you know, villages and carry off captives. And then they would become enslaved and, you know, have their sort of place, you know, within the society. And this went on down into the 1950s. And when, you know, during land reform and other movements and this caste system was broken up, and the enslavement ended. There's still an awareness of this sort of caste thing among the Norsu today, but the old ways have been broken up. And again, they speak Tibeto-Burman languages. And of course, there's many other groups in Southwest China, such as Nashi and Lahu and so forth, who Lisu, who speak Tibeto-Burman languages. There's also possibly some ancient connections to the ancient Nanzhou kingdom back in, you know, 7th or 8th century, contiguous with the Tang dynasty. Seems to have been traditions of writing, which go quite far back. The Bimo priests that I mentioned before had systems of writing. This Book of Origins that we translated is from a written text that was recorded by Jivo Zochu, who in his younger days was an epic singer. These big life-cycle events of weddings and funerals, passages of the epic are sung at these things, and Jivo Zochu was kind of a performer at these events, which could be quite competitive between, you know, singers of different families and so forth. And later, during the Cultural Revolution, he got a hold of written versions, and it was taught to read by an older ritualist. And he copied the ancient text, the ancient scrolls that he had, into a modern version of the E script, which was developed in the 1970s. And that's the basis of the text that we used as our translation. And in the introduction, I, you know, go into some detail about the traditional Norsu language, written language. It's all written in verse. It covers various sorts of histories, origin texts, things to do with astronomy, astrology, herbal medicine, folklore, and even some what we might call literary sort of narratives. And there were several centers for this e-writing, Guizhou. A lot of texts have been collected from the Guizhou area in western Guizhou. And this Book of Origins, it circulates orally and in writing. The priests or ritualists called Bimo, this is sort of a father to son sort of thing in most cases. And these texts would be handed down within families and networks of Bimo. There's, just like anything in the folk tradition, you know, a lot of variation. When these things, when these epics are performed orally, there's even more possibilities for variation in terms of what's going to be sung when, what's going to be emphasized, and so forth. And Bamo Chubomo did a lot of research on this. There's been quite a few versions, well over a dozen versions in writing of this collected, and some published in Chinese translation. But what we were looking for was a text that had not gone through any sort of editorial process other than at the very local level by a local folk literati or by Bimoa themselves. And so Aku Wuwu knew about Jivo Zochu, and sometime around 2005 or so, we began engaging with him. And I, you know, this is explained in the preface and introduction as well. And then we got into this process where we created this system by which to, decode the epic from Norsu into Chinese. And so we had, developed the Chinese version of, and also developed the English version as well. So the English version has been, along with an online supplement in Norsu or standard E, Northern E, romanization, that's been published. We're still waiting on a Chinese Norsu version, which will eventually appear. But some of the things that are given in the introduction, aside from traditional writing, we have things on traditional cosmology. We have things on, marriage customs, funeral customs, various passages on the structure, the poetic structure of the epics, performance contexts, and so forth. So that's what much of the introduction comprises. Some of the introduction is also devoted to various sections of the epics, sort of telling, what happens in each section. The first major section deals with origins of things. Starts with the creation of the sky and earth, separation of the sky and earth, some things about lightning. And then you have these various gods are delegated by the head sky spirit to come down and implant life on earth. And then you get into these various mythical heroes, including this sort of monkey-like figure who is also, a creator figure and has certain tasks. And then finally, we get to these passages on this culture hero called Zhuge Alu, who is the son of a woman named Pumo Ni, and she was the she's the only woman in the Book of Origins where you've got her genealogy there. Genealogy is a huge thing among the Norsu, but it's primarily patriarchal, patrilineal, genealogy. But her genealogy is there, and she's got some relationship maybe to dragons. But one day she was weaving out in front of her house, and these dragon eagles flew over, and some droplets of blood fell down and touched her body in several places. And soon after, she felt strange and went to consult a Bimoa, and the Bimoa did these various divinations on her and said, well, you're going to give birth to a supernatural being. And she does. She gives birth to this unusual child who won't listen to things, won't drink her milk, won't wear clothes properly, and won't eat, food properly. And so she casts him out into the wilderness to be raised by dragons. And so he's raised by dragons, but later grows up into this the culture hero who eventually the world enters this age of overheating, where everything is burning, the land is shriveling, all the plants are shriveling, the animals are dying off, people are having a rough go of it. And so Zhuge Alu eventually shoots down the extra suns that had been made during the time of creation. And so we only have one sun and one moon today because of that. Now, that's a story that is shared with a number of other ethnic groups. It's a very, very old Chinese story in Chinese mythology and Han Chinese mythology, but also the Miao people have a very, very similar story of this hero shooting down the extra suns and moons in the sky. So there's a huge section on Zhiga Alu. But what follows after that is a section upon which there's another reseeding of life on Earth. Okay, so you've got the life force falls down onto the Earth once it's cooled down, and then you get these series of snowfalls, and finally a red snowfall, which kind of combines with this life force, which is falling down. And all Norsu women are said to have this life force. It's the force that allows people to become pregnant. And so this force is dropped to Earth. And out of this mix, eventually we get this sort of series of anthropomorphs who eventually become humans. And these life forms, the nascent life forms, are divided into the sons or children or offspring of snow. And you've got six that have blood and six groups that do not have blood. So those without blood are the various trees and grasses and other plants, and those with blood are various sorts of animals, which would include things like large birds, monkeys, bears, frogs, snakes, and humans. And those are just kind of representative of the various life forms. And so it's quite interesting that humans are put into that mix, and this kind of what some of the South American eco-critics have described as this kind of pluriverse, which is, you know, sort of a reflection of that sort of Amazonian worldview or worldview of some of the ethnic indigenous people in South America. This sort of terms become kind of popular over the last couple of decades, this idea of a pluriverse rather than just a human-centered universe. But at any rate, after a number of generations, the ancestors of those, you know, original humans, this one person called Shirley Wato goes off searching for a father, okay, on this big thing. So this is kind of this notion that the original matrilineal society is sort of shifting into the patrilineal. This is what, you know, Chinese researchers read into the text. And so Shirley Wato goes off in search of a father, and in the process finds a marriage partner, and all these various customs surrounding marriages and so forth, and how to treat guests at weddings and etc. Happen. And then one of his offspring, or descendants rather, there suddenly becomes a time when there's going to be a great flood. You know, you have these messengers from the sky come down and say that, you know, certain humans have done certain bad things, and there's going to be a great flood. And so one of the good sons of a particular family is allowed to survive the flood, and eventually marries the daughter of the sky god, and she comes down from the sky, and he travels up to the sky. At that time, there were routes to the sky on these sort of wires or chains of metal to the sky, and he brings her back to Earth, and she brings with her things like horses and hemp and buckwheat, because that's a staple of the Norsu, and sort of steals these. And her father's not too happy about that, so he cuts off the links to the sky and Earth. And eventually, this earthling and celestial goddess, daughter of the sky god, they give birth to three offspring, three children, but they can't speak. And so they have to go up to the sky again with the help of various animals, some of which the young earthling had helped, Jumu helped save from the flood. And so these creatures help him recover the key to speech. Okay, this one bird called the Apoyochu bird flies up there and overhears the sky god chatting with his wife, and then flies back down. And so eventually the husband and wife on earth, the earthling and the sky god's daughter, they go up to the top of this big mountain and have this big pot of boiling water and put bamboo in it, and the bamboo explodes and shocks their children into speaking. And they each speak a different language. One speaks Nuosu, another speaks Tibetan, and another speaks Chinese. Now, of course, the names for these ethnic groups are a little bit different than what they are today in the epic. And thereafter, in this last portion of the epic, these various ethnic groups fan out across the landscape and find their ideal niches. So the Tibetans find their places, the Han people find their places, which tend to be really nice places along rivers, and the Nuosu find their places up in the mountains. You know, Tibetans are in the grasslands or whatever. But there's also, oddly enough, in this version of the Noble, there's also another group called the Foreigners, and nobody can really quite figure out who they are, but there, it's another group that's that they don't say too much about them, but they're there. And but anyway, several of these last sections chart some of these big clans, because every Nuosu is in a clan. It's all genealogy, and traditionally when two people meet, they're saying off their clan genealogies, which can go back dozens of generations sometimes, and trying to find a common ancestor between them. And so that's a big big part of Nuosu mentality, is this whole genealogy thing, which fits in with this whole theme of the Book of Origins, the connectedness of everything. And so some of these last chapters, which are quite challenging because a lot of them are just these endless listings of begats. This generation begat this generation, begat this generation, begat this generation. So there's not a whole lot of narrative content in most of it. But as I had explained in the introduction, I spent part of the introduction explaining how a lot of this is within sort of the context of searching for an ideal place to settle down. And that's a big theme. And quite a few of these epic poems from Southwest China, there's this sort of search for an ideal place where people can settle down, where things grow right, where there's good water, where there's good resources for firewood and that kind of stuff, and where they can grow, strong children and et cetera, and have a good future ahead of them. And so that's what the last portions of this are these sort of accounts of the genealogies of these various clans, some of which are quite identifiable with existing clans today. A lot of the place names in this part, not really sure exactly where things are, but some of them are recognizable. So that's sort of an overview of things.
It's incredible, and thank you. And I can only imagine how difficult it is to distill an entire epic into about 20 minutes, and the background of the community that maintains this and transmits this epic. So, but I feel like a lot of that comes across really nicely. I guess I wanted to further pull out on one point. You said that there's a Nuosu version available online. Where can people find that if they've listened this far and are interested in finding it?
Yeah, the Nuosu version, I think that there's actually a link to that, which is mentioned in somewhere in the front matter of the text. But if you type in Norsu Book of Origins, Norsu text, you'll probably find it somehow or another.
Great.
And that was put up through University of Washington Press.
Should it be on their website then?
That I'm not sure. It might be.
Okay, we'll try to find
it. But if anybody has questions, they can email me at bender.4@osu.edu.
We'll also try and find a version that we can then include a link of in the show notes for this episode. All right, and I was wondering, do you have the book sort of to hand at the moment?
Yeah, I have it right next to me, actually.
Okay. Would you feel comfortable, and it's okay if it's not, I'll tell them to edit this last bit out. But would you feel comfortable sort of maybe reading the English of a section, or like just a little bit, just to sort of give a sense of how you've chosen to translate it?
I could read just a little bit of the last part. I don't want
to
really read any of the front part because I'm not a BMO, and
yeah.
That would be their sort of thing,
right?
But this may be part of the maybe from page 114, genealogy of Chuanizu. Just a few lines from this. And this, again, it's a genealogy of one of the clans. So just a few lines. A son of the whore was the luck of the whore. A son of the whore was the luck of the whore. The whore migrated to a distant place. And after entering the distant place, they selected a red cow right away. Over 100 pack cows came along in front. The pack cow, Lunza, led the way on the return. The livestock were uncountable. One day they went to select horses. The spirit and magic horses led the way. The creatures without cloven hooves were uncountable. Quarried stone was selected in the middle. Gold and silver were set in a row. Their uses were uncountable. Lastly, the pack string leader was selected. Over 100 youths followed in front. Over 100 maidens followed in front. Things in the human world were uncountable.
Oh, that's really great. And just to sort of follow up a little bit further on something that you said in sort of leading up to selecting this section, you said that the earlier sections are sort of the domain of the BMO.
Well, all of it is. I mean, all of this is BMO, but this last thing was more, these last parts are more genealogies, which can be read in various ritual contexts. And at any time that there is a ritual in that the BMO conduct, there's always some sort of a reading of genealogies of the family, and very often the local families in the area. But the sort of thing that these first parts of the epic, which they actually divide. There's various ways to talk about these parts of the epic. So some parts, which would mostly the part early parts on the doings of the gods and Juga Alu, et cetera, would be called the Black Noah. And then these things about after the 12 Sons of Snow and this whole business with the flood and the migrations, that's sometimes called the White Noah. And then sometimes just those sections about the creation of plants and animals are called the Mottled Noah. So there's all kinds of local interpretations and insider understandings of the text with concurrent terminology, which we go into to some extent in the introduction.
Great, great. Well, thank you so much. I'm realizing that in trying to get you to talk about an entire epic alongside your entire career of studying epics, we've taken up a lot of your time. I was wondering if you'd be willing to, just as a way of wrapping things up, Tell us a little bit more about what you're working on now.
What we're working on now is I'm working I got some stuff in the work with Juan Carlos Galeano, who's an Amazonian, a poet, and who participated in a ethnic minority literature event at Southwest University for Nationalities back probably about, 5 or 6 years ago. I think it was around 2017 or something. And he's taken somewhat of an interest in Akuwu's poem. So we're working together on doing some sort of a, this is still just in the very early stages, but a trilingual sort of edition of Akuwu's major poetry in Norsu and some in Chinese and English and Spanish. So that's what we're looking at now. I'm also looking, considering doing another translation of, there's something called Mamotoi, which is this sort of book of teachings, which has to do with customary behavior among the Norsu, and but I'm still thinking about that.
It all sounds really fascinating. I'm particularly interested. I mean, the idea of translating Aku's poems now into also Spanish and sort of creating this tri or even quadrilingual edition sounds really fascinating, but also sort of as a really interesting project. So I can't wait to see more about it. Thank you very much, Professor Bender, for your time today and for taking the time to talk about your book, The Norsu Book of Origins.
Well, thank you, Tim. This has been a wonderful experience. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.